This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
You've written a new book called The Hype Cycle. What is The Hype Cycle?
The Hype Cycle is a book about the way in which we are basically culturally governed. So we live in an age where it's harder to govern people because they're not afraid of God anymore. And the old narrative that the state represents God and therefore we should fear the state when we fear God doesn't work anymore. And then there is, at least in the Western Hemisphere, there's not yet enough poverty to govern by famine and you know, massive suppression of the basic needs. So when people are not hungry and don't believe in God anymore, it becomes hard to govern them. And Nietzsche recognizes this, and also other classical thinkers at the beginning, at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century said it will be harder to rule if you don't have faith anymore. And so now you need to replace classical faith by some ideology to rule. And communism did this via the communist Marxist ideology. We did it for many decades in the West by consumerism, which worked pretty well, and a kind of basic economic participation of everyone in consumerism. But now we have more scarcity, and so now the new pattern of rule is these hype cycles, which are, there are two types. There are scientific hypes, which are based on the sciences, like the climate type or COVID type. And then there are cultural hypes, like the diversity, equity, inclusion hype or transgender hype. And both are used to create a permanent state of emergency to get people to obey to the rule and to the political will formation of the elite.
So you're arguing that these hype cycles are manufactured, therefore they are not organic. Can hype cycles be organic?
So they are to a certain extent organic. So it's clever rulers always utilize spontaneously evolving cultural trends to utilize them and to reinforce them. So it's impossible to force a population to buy into a hype to which it's not anyhow prone, which is not already spontaneously evolving. For example, they tried the vaccination hype 15 years ago against SARS-CoV-1 and MERS, and also the swine flu, the bird flu in the 2010s. And it failed because the populations were not ready. But 10 years later, in 2020, there was a certain cultural readiness to accept the COVID hype. And only the Northern Hemisphere countries accepted it. You know, the Southern Hemisphere, where you live, the hype didn't work as well, especially in Sub-Saharan Africa. They didn't buy into it. So it really depends. It also has a spontaneous aspect to it.
But then why do some hype cycles become so appealing?
That has to do a lot with huge cultural differences. Today, thanks to globalism, which is itself a hype, which I also discuss in the book, thanks to globalism, we have this illusion that the culture is similar everywhere. But that's just a Western cliché. In reality, as you know, living in South Africa, you live in a very Western sub-community of South Africans, but there is also a non-Western community in South Africa, right? And the cultural differences are massive. And I think the cultural differences explain why some populations accept such hypes and others don't, and that some hypes work very well somewhere and don't work in other places.
The implication of saying cycle means that it repeats.
I believe these hypes have always played a role in mass psychology and in human perception. And I think that they are a repeating element of dominance and rule. And I think that what changes are the contents, right? So a very interesting example was from 2020 to the spring of 2022, we had this corona hype cycle. And then, which was expensive to maintain, because if you observed what was going on with your bare eyes without reading the press, you couldn't see anything, okay, you could see that there were lockdowns and people wearing masks, but nobody was. But when the plague was devastating Europe, you could see piles of dead bodies on the streets waiting to be taken away by the lorries and so on. And so there was nothing like this happening. So it was very expensive to sustain the hype, and it cost a lot of money. And when they stopped spending this money and reporting it, the hype died away. But then they immediately started the Ukraine hype. Everywhere we saw Ukraine flags here in Europe. And so there, a new hype was created, which was much more artificial than the COVID hype, actually. And so you could see how they switched from one hype pattern to the next. That's what I mean with the word cycle.
Is the purpose of a hype cycle to manipulate?
Yeah, so it's about getting people to buy into accepting the political will formation of a minority. So there's a tiny minority which has some political goals it wants to achieve. And these political goals are harmful to the vast majority of the population because they're not in their interest. Like the feudal lords, they were all the time fighting to get bigger territories that they could rule in the Middle Ages and also the Renaissance. And this was, of course, not in the interest of the peasants who were producing all the goods, right? And to justify it, there was an ideology. And it's the same today. We have a very small elite that is ruling the West. And a lot of what it's doing is not in our interest, but they have to kind of hide it. And that's why they create this hype ideology.
Is a variation of your two hype cycles, fear and hope.
Yes. So usually what you very often have, you have a fear hype cycle that is started first, and then you have a hope hype. So for example, in the Cold War, the fear hype was the Soviet Union is going to attack Western Europe, which was never the case. The Soviets never planned, Stalin didn't plan it, and then also Khrushchev and Brezhnev didn't plan to invade Western Europe. They had other goals, you know. They wanted to consolidate their huge empire, which was it was super big geographically. It's still, right? And they had other aims. But the fear cycle was created that people should be afraid of the Russians. And then hope was nuclear armament and also conventional armament. So there was then a hope cycle created. Oh, but if we, you know, if we spend billions and billions of the taxpayer money for weapons, then we can have hope that the Russians cannot attack us. So that was a classical fear hope cycle. Another one was the COVID fear of the virus and the hope from the vaccine.
In your book, you lay out a bunch of hope cycles. Take me through some of them.
So hope cycles. So one is the vaccine. So the HIV treatment hope, the hope of being able to heal COVID. The quantum hype is also hope cycle. Then diversity, equity, inclusion hype, which is a cultural hype, is also a hope cycle because it hopes to change all the grievances of mankind. Transgender hype is a hope cycle. Gender language hype is a hope cycle. So many of these positive hypes, which can be subsumed under what I call postmodern collectivism, others call it cultural Marxism, these are all hope cycles as well.
Okay, and then you also have a whole bunch of fear cycles, AI being one of them.
Yes, AI is a big fear cycle, though there's also a bit of hope in it, because we are told that AI will wipe out human labor, that it will replace human labor and make us superfluous, and that it's also AI could become more intelligent than man and then rule the world, and that we have to be afraid of this and to take measures against this.
Just quickly on that, a little bit of a segue, but I was having a conversation a few days ago with a family member, and he was saying that, for example, in the agricultural sector here in South Africa, many farmers are mechanizing and using more technology, which comes at the cost of labor. You start firing farm workers because you're using more machines, and he was making the point that those farm workers will end up on the streets.
So if you look at the history of industrialization, what happened in the 19th century was that first there were there were a lot of farm labor hands who were underemployed, which went into the cities when industrialization happened. And then, of course, what also happened that was that agriculture was mechanized and that there was less work. Now, these people didn't end up on the street because the quickly growing industrial production soaked them up, right? And so basically they just changed their jobs from farm working to working in factories. And I think that if you have a growing economy, there's always work, but people have to change the type of work they do in their lifetime. And, you know, part of me, I'm an old social democrat, so I believe that the state, one of the tasks of the state is to help the very low educated people to change the job, right? Not by subsidizing them, but to offer programs for re-educating them or helping them to evolve so that they can meet this challenge of changing job. To some extent, this is a role the state can take. But these transitions are natural since we have industrialization, and this type of mechanization is a blessing and not a threat. The nature of the work is changing, new work is coming up. Now, if AI, however, could mechanize all the intellectual work that is being done, also the simple one that's done by clerks, if that would be the case, if, for example, there would not be any need anymore for phone, right, for phone-based services, then there would be a real problem, because then the AI could take up all the work. But this will not happen because AI is not intelligent. So there is the classical mechanization, I think, is a blessing, because it removes repetitive and hard labor and frees us of it and gives us opportunities to have more interesting work. But if AI could really take over everything humans do, then it would be a real problem.
There seems to be a false dichotomy here. The fear is based on the fact that the amount of work available is like a closed system, and you're suggesting it's actually an infinite system.
Yes, so exactly. So it's an open system. So basically, of course, there are limits to growth. A certain amount of people on Earth is probably, there's probably a certain maximum where it's still, you know, pleasant to live on Earth. We don't know where this maximum is, but the problem of overpopulation is anyhow already over. We don't have this problem anymore, because globally fertility rates are declining. And it might actually become the opposite, that we might become worried about fertility. But this taken aside, yes, I think that there is no natural limit to growth, and that a growing economy can always create new opportunities for work and for participation, for economic participation, which is what work in the end is, you know.
One of the biggest fear cycles in existence is the climate change one.
I actually was myself believing in the climate hype until maybe 2012, when I sat at a dinner next to a geophysicist to explain to me that this is all ridiculous. And he started getting paper and writing down the equations to model the climate. The IPCC's model, he sketched it out for me, and I was laughing at it. And then I started reading and read a lot of literature until I was ready to write this book chapter, which summarizes the main arguments that though man may contribute to very small extent to the global warming that we have experienced since 1850, the contribution of man is small and it's mostly a natural cycle. And so that the whole, everything around climate emergency and man-made climate change is real nonsense, and that we should not try to change the natural course of the climate by artificial measures.
Sure, but this is the largest agenda in the world. I mean, this is pretty much the heart of the IPCC. It's the heart of the G20 that just occurred here in South Africa. It's the heart of everything, the carbon economy.
Yes. Now, the only way to crack it is like the way that Luther cracks the Catholic dogma of the 16th century, right? By pointing out its inner self-contradictions and problems and unveiling it as what it was, the hugest fear hype cycle ever. Was Catholic theology of the 16th century. And now we have a similarly big fear narrative that is that resembles the Catholic one of the 16th century, which is the climate panic, which is promoted by the new church, right? There's like these institutions act like a huge big church. Curtis Jarvin, whom I really don't like, calls it the cathedral to symbolize it. I think it's just a neo-religion with the very same function than the Catholicism of the 16th century, which is to instill massive fear into the population, then get them to buy these indulgency letters. And today, the indulgency letters is the buy-in to this global agenda, the global green agenda, which I think is terrible, is destructive, is taking away life, and is the worst thing that we have seen probably as a fear cycle since the 16th century.
I've invited Curtis onto my show, but he hasn't responded. I'm fascinated by why you don't like the cathedral concept. I always thought it was quite good.
I don't like Curtis Jarvin because he's a transhumanist. So his whole philosophy is based on transhumanism, which is also a hype, which I describe in the book. And transhumanism is the idea that we can use technology to change the nature of humans. And either to fuse humans with machines, to create cyborgs, to create artificial intelligence that can read our thoughts and rule us. And it's also the idea that we can genetically optimize ourselves. All of this is scientific nonsense, and all of this is impossible, as I show with Barry in the AI book, but also in the hype book. But Curtis Jarvin and also Nick Land make this wrong idea the foundation of their entire political philosophy. And then they develop a political philosophy based on transhumanism, which is massively technocratic. So they are both technocrats justifying a technocratic rule by a small minority. They want to abolish political participation in the political will formation. So interviewing him is certainly interesting because he's very radical and very important. He's basically the ideological foundation of Elon Musk.
Yuval Harari.
Yes, and Yuval Harari, and so on. So he's very important today, but his thinking is very shallow. And that's very interesting. Let me just say this one sentence, is that it's so shallow because the Catholic Church had a very, very complicated foundation, philosophical foundation, which was very sophisticated. And so had the bourgeois ideology proclaimed by John Locke, David Hume, and Immanuel Kant. But today's transhumanists, technocrats have a very shallow ideology.
No, I agree with you, but I was saying his metaphor of the cathedral I thought was quite accurate when he was describing the establishment. You say you don't like that metaphor.
Oh, yeah, I think it's because it's a bit too narrow. I rather would call it church because right. The cathedral is, but it's still a good metaphor. I mean, this guy has a gift for picking words. He's a good writer. That's why he's successful. I'm not saying that he's just very shallow philosophically and it's a very interesting, phenomenon that such a shallow thinker has such an importance. This wouldn't have been possible two or three generations ago. But the elite itself has declined so much intellectually. I mean, if you were talking to the elite of two generations ago, they were quoting Homer or Thucydides or Kant to justify their ideas. Now they're quoting Star Wars and Curtis Jarvin.
I've read some of the Dark Enlightenment and it was very complex, unless I am missing something.
Yeah, but if you compare to Kant's writings about the metaphysics of the state, it's still rather shallow. It's not culturally, it doesn't have the depth of the high end philosophy that used to be the ideology of the West, right? It's philosophically, I'm not saying the language is simple or anything. I'm just saying that the ideas are very, very, poorly grounded, and that the arguments don't have the depth that we are used to. If you read Marsilius of Padua, who invented the term sovereignty in the 14th century or 15th century, Dante's writings about the monarchy, they have just much more depth. You see, complexity also.
Going back to the climate hype cycle,
yes.
It does seem to me though, Jobst, that a lot more people today seem to be dismissing it.
Yes, so because I think the reason is that we live in an age of positivism where people expect that things that are true should also be verifiable in reality. That's also why it was so hard to uphold the COVID narrative, because it was visible that almost no one was dying, right? And so now with the climate change thing is that there hasn't been the global warming has more or less stopped 15, 20 years ago. There is no big further trend of further heating up of the planet. I believe that's because we are back to we have recovered from the small ice age of the Renaissance period and are now back in the Holocene norm. So there is no further warming up. There are no unnatural catastrophes visible. So people think, well, why should I, not have a car anymore, not heat my house properly anymore, and relinquish all the goods of modern industrial society, if there's nothing is going on? So I think the skepticism comes from the lack of observability of the phenomena that the climate freaks describe.
So I've had this conversation numerous times. Their response is now always the same. It's not about the changing climate, but the rate at which it changes.
But the rate of change has totally slowed down, right? I mean, there was, from 1850 to 2000, there was indeed a warm up of the Earth by 0.7 to 0.9 degree. Right, which is a fast rate, but the ocean levels didn't rise. They didn't rise significantly. They rose a little bit, but since 7,000 years they haven't risen very much. And when it's claimed that they rise somewhere, it's because rather the ground goes down, drops, because too much water is taken out of the earth, or too many buildings are built on the coastline. But in reality, there is no significant increase of the ocean levels. Now, if you look at the ocean level development since over the last 15,000 years, between I think 13,000 BC and 7,000 BC, it rose by several hundred yards. And that's a fast climate change. But we haven't had, because that was the end of the last big ice period. And before that, Europe was covered with a 1 kilometer thick ice shield. And when this melted away, of course, there was a huge, within just a few thousand years, there was a big climate change. But now we don't have anything like this. So if you compare what we are witnessing today against historic effects, there is really no climate change. And the second argument is, of course, that the models that predict a future huge change are mathematically nonsensical and deeply wrong. So they are invalid models, and these invalid models are always used by the fanaticists or fanatics to point out the problems of climate change. But in reality, there is nothing like this happening.
Ah, but yups, come now. The rate of change has slowed because of all the efforts of humanity. So we must continue.
So actually the CO2 emissions have continued to rise. Despite all the efforts, the only effort that really worked out was there were these fluoride molecules that were used in fridges. I don't remember their name now, that were used in the 70s and 60s. And they were banned in the 80s to prevent the ozone, damaging of the ozone layer. And this may really have worked, though I'm not so certain about it. But that's all. Otherwise, there was never a decrease in the CO2 emissions. There are a few fanatic countries like Germany, England, Switzerland, who have actually reduced their carbon dioxide emissions. But China, the US, And Russia and India are increasing their CO2 production, so that there has never been any reduction. And so now we don't have a change in the temperature anymore, despite the increased CO2 production. And why is this the case? Because we are already, the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is already above the range in which it still influences the climate, I believe.
I stood in a greenhouse where I think the CO2 parts per million were over 1,000, because obviously they're pumping in CO2.
Yes.
And I didn't die, Jobst.
Of course not. You only die if the CO2 concentration is in the double digit percent. I don't know where the limit is, but at 70% you die. No, it's actually not true. It must be so high that to kill you, it must be higher than 70. Because if it's 70, there's still 20% oxygen. So it must displace the oxygen. And where you have this, where people are really dying, is in wine cellars. If there's no control of the air movement, that the CO2 that comes from the wine barrels is displacing the oxygen, and people entering there to do some work, they can actually get into a CO2 narcosis and die. So this has regularly happened in wine production and is very dangerous. But of course, we are here talking 1,000 parts per million is just 1 per mil. So it's not toxic at all.
Another fear hype cycle in your book is medical interventions. I mean, yes. COVID is just one. AIDS is another. But
yes.
you would think by now we would be magnificently healthy with all the medical interventions. It doesn't seem to be the case.
So one has to be very careful when talking about medicine. So if you think of surgery, which arose from warfare, of course, modern surgery was a product of warfare. Surgery is wonderful because if you have a complicated fracture of your arm or leg, you became a cripple before modern surgery was invented. Now with modern surgery, you can heal these such accidents, and they are not so rare. So they occur quite frequently. You can just fall down the stairs. You can have such a fracture. You could even die of it, because if you had an open fracture, it could become infected, and then you could die of the bacterial infection. So there are areas of medicine that are wonderful, like modern surgery, also, you know, heart transplantation, which was invented in your country, and many other aspects of medicine, like the ability to have antibiotics against bacteria. So the reason, though, that we are not very much healthier is that this has been offset by the negative effects of medicine. And we also are, to some extent, poisoning big parts of the population using the wrong medicine, or also by poisoning our environment. And that's what's offsetting the progress that I've just described.
These are scientists. These are doctors. They've all had immense training. They know what they're doing.
Yes. So it's a massive cultural hype. And as you can see, I mean, what's interesting is that with the COVID vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, people have become suspicious of them, right? Even normal people who trust their doctors are now suspicious of these types of vaccines. So I think if the damage that's done by a drug is big enough, you can have kind of a reaction, gut reaction by the population. But you're right, there's a big discrepancy between the knowledge and training and reputation of the doctors and the normal people. And this is what sustains the medical hypes. Now, the problem is that though, you know, for a long time, the pharmaceutical industry has produced drugs that were harmful, there was never a systematic poisoning of the population, a knowing systematic poisoning of the population, like with the nucleic acids-based vaccines. And that is what worries me. That's why I wrote the book, because the hypes have become more and more aggressive. And now we have a situation which is similar to what the Britons did in China in the 19th century with the opium wars, that we are forcing a toxic drug on our own population. So the Britons did it, quote-unquote, to the Chinese underdogs, you know, whom they didn't perceive as real humans, but we do it to our own populations now. I think that's very worrying.
But the problem with a hype like the medical one is that you end up seeing a lot of binary responses. Well, I'm not going to trust any doctor anymore. I'm not going to trust any medicine anymore. And that is also a little bit too much to the other side, because it ignores, yes, it ignores complexity and nuance.
Exactly. So it's very hard when you get abused, like our populations got abused by the medical system during the COVID period. It creates overreactions. And so people are, in a way, you know, avoiding doctors altogether, saying we don't believe in anything anymore. And that may be very stupid. So because modern medicine has also many, many good potentials. But I have had the experience that many of my friends keep calling me because, I studied medicine and mathematics, but I also studied medicine. I'm also a medical doctor. So they call me and said, should I take this drug or that drug? The doctor has prescribed it, but I don't know whether I should trust him anymore. So this is very bad that the trust has eroded. But it has eroded for a good reason.
It's more of an academic discussion, but globalism versus globalization. Yes. I just want some clarity here. When you talk about globalization, what do you mean?
So when I talk about the traditional globalism is about is David Ricardo's idea of the competitive advantage that you have an advantage in one country and another advantage in another country, and by exchanging goods, both countries benefit. Right. So one country has very, very rich soil. The other country where you can produce agricultural goods very easily. The other one has minerals and can export the minerals. And now you can exchange the goods and create a mutual benefit. That's the old idea of globalism. It never worked like Ricardo described it. But there is something to international trade as a beneficial social norm. And this is what classical globalism is. Globalization is an ideology. Or maybe I just confounded the two terms. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. One of them I describe as positive, which is basically, I think it was globalization, I'm sorry, which is basically the trade of goods for the benefit of everyone. And globalism is the ideology that there should be a unified global culture and also one world government. Right. And I think that this is a dangerous ideology. And I think it's wrong to believe that only one set of ideas should be applied to everyone and that everybody should live under one jurisdiction. I think it's a very, very dangerous ideology. That's globalism. Globalization is just exchange of goods, which is fundamentally a good idea.
But what's wrong with having central governance? You know, this is a good thing. This can bring more harmony. This can bring less poverty. It can bring more equality, et cetera, more egalitarianism.
Yes, so the key idea is self-determination and subsidiarity here. So what is self-determination? Self-determination means that people who have a similar culture decide at a local level what the state should do and how the necessity of the state, which is a necessity in human life, should be dealt with and fulfilled. So the state needs to collect taxes, so it takes away the product of our labor to create a public good. How should this public good look like? How much should the state be allowed to take away from us, and what should it really do? And the more you centralize, the further away you get from the people contributing to the state, and the more you create an elite that is detached from those who actually pay the taxes and have to toil for the state. And that's the big problem with centralized government, is that it's very, very prone to abuse. So if the government is local and state officials abuse their power, it's immediately found out and they are stopped from doing it. So the control of power is very good if you have power at the local level. That was even true in feudalism. Because a ruling knight with a small parish that he was ruling just a few thousand citizens, they could immediately spot when he was doing something wrong, and then they could protest, and he couldn't abuse to more than a certain extent. And I think that if you abstract government and create units that are further and further apart from the citizens, the chance of the citizens to participate in the political will formation becomes worse and worse. And this is what those naive proponents of centralization don't see. They don't see that the biggest evil of communism was centralization, because it takes away the participation possibilities of the citizens and creates an anonymous, terrible structure which is then Kafkaesque and which rules in a cold and detached way against the will of the population. That's what's always happening when you centralize.
But let me play devil's advocate, if you don't mind.
Please.
I was recently in China, and it's quite centralized and authoritarian, highly safe, highly efficient. Everything seems to go according to how it's supposed to go.
So I think that that China is a very complicated phenomenon. I think that China is a very heterogeneous country. I think that there is a stretch of the country by the coast that has become very homogenized and that has a tradition of centralized culture where this works. But then in the periphery, which you never see as a foreigner, there is also a lot of conflict, because the culturally different people living in the periphery don't want this centralized rule. They would like to decide to live in a different way, and they are forced to follow the centralized rules, and that doesn't work very well. So I think the picture that we have of China as Westerners is distorted by the places that we visit, and also China never has had a culture of mass participation in the political will formation. It has always been centralized, always eliticist. So the Chinese are used to being governed in this way, like the Russians are. But in the West, we have had since 2,500 years, the idea that citizens should rule themselves, right? That they should be their own masters, that they should be able to decide about their own, the way they live and form their own ideas, and participate in the power and in also in the fruit of society. And this idea was born in Athens, and it spread all over the West, and it's still a very powerful idea. And so therefore it's not possible to rule Westerners like you can rule the Chinese.
But is the idea of centralization centered around scalability? Let me give you an example. Is it fair to say that your home is quite centralized because it makes it more efficient?
Yes, but it's a small unit. But of course, you have central heating in your home, right? Because having multiple wood burning stoves in the house, like it was, 100 years ago, is less efficient. So of course, the idea of centralization can drive efficiency and also efficacy, both, right? So it can create better effects and also at less costs. However, that's also true at the state level, and there are some goals and projects for which a centralized community can make sense, or even a centralized governance body, like for example for space exploration. It's so expensive, right, that it makes sense to build the International Space Station with the participation of all the states, and to create a body that governs this International Space Station, and so on. And if there would be a true pandemic, it might also be justified to create a global body to fight it in a synchronous and coordinated manner. So it all depends on the problem at hand. Now, at the moment, I see very few problems that require such efforts, and most problems should be, managed at the local or at the state level, but not at the global level. But if such problems arise, we have a kind of state of emergency, about which I also talk in the last chapter of the book, and then there's a justification for centralized governance and also for pausing democratic participation, because democratic participation is time costly.
Are there any hype cycles that have a positive net effect?
Yeah, so one good example is Reformation. I think you are yourself such an example, right? You're not Catholic, are you?
I'm not Catholic.
Yeah, so I think your ancestors were Protestants, and Protestantism was a hype in the 16th century, but it was a positive hype because it transformed Europe. It made Europe more innovative. It led ultimately to democratization. It enabled enlightenment. So there are ideas that become contagious and that also become hypes. If you look at the way that Protestantism spread in the 16th century, which was very positive. I also believe that to some extent Enlightenment itself was a positive hype. Of course, that there are exaggerations and problems, but overall, I think that new ideas that arise spontaneously and become fascinating to many people, that can be very, very positive. The same is the fascination for technology. So why are young people studying engineering or physics? Because they get fascinated by technology. They are hyped by it. They find it just intriguing, that the way you can manipulate nature, that create technology, they become engineers, and without engineers, nothing would work. So hype waves are important for human societies. It's not necessarily something negative.
I'm not sure if this is in your book, because I went through it fairly quickly, but political hype cycles are also a very interesting phenomenon. If you look at Obama and Trump and the hype around them, which was a combination of organic and manufactured.
Yes. Yes, go ahead.
Mm. I was going to add to that if you talk to the MAGA folks, they will tell you that this is a positive net effect hype. But if you talk to the Democrats, they'll say no.
Okay, so these political hypes are very short-lived, and their task is to convince the population that the opponent to the current administration is actually a real alternative. I believe that we live in post-democratic societies in the West, where the opponent up for election is not anymore an alternative and doesn't change the way that we are ruled. It's only a small cultural change. And Trump is actually, in some respects, a real change, but not fundamentally. Fundamentally, the same families who own, you know, the entire, what I call strategic property, they dominate the political agenda and they create the political will that we experience. And the politicians that are chosen only have the task to make the rule that we are under acceptable. So I think these hypes around, oh, Trump is a real alternative and so on, they're very superficial and they are a sign of a lack of understanding how the political will formation in the West really works today.
But they're also a combination of both fear and hope.
Yes.
At the same time.
Yes, absolutely. And it's very important to mobilize the emotions of the population in a democracy to sustain the illusion of participation. And if you believe that by voting Trump, you can really change something significantly, then that's good. But in reality, I believe that the changes that Trump is making are not made because the political elites are following the will formation of the masses, but because the real elites see that the old pattern was in some ways inefficient for their own goals. Like mass migration, the United States were very favorable to mass migration. The elites were very much in favor of it. Now it seems that they have changed their mind. Now they seem to think that mass migration is also bad for their own intentions and benefits.
Hypes are cycles. Then is there any point in pushing back since they're just going to come back?
Well, so if you push back against certain types, so at some point the Chinese managed to get rid of the opium import or the opium trade that was forced upon them by the British, right? So there are some types of hype or rule which is formulated as hype, which are very, very dangerous. Like in our case, the nucleic acid-based vaccinations. And, you know, they are now planning to change the anti-vaccination schedule to nucleic acid-based vaccinations. This would be terrible. It would really, really kill a lot of children. It would be absolutely horrible. And so I think it's, even if a new hype cycle will come, it's very important to fight against the most dangerous ones to avoid this type of abuse. The same is true for the war hype. I have a chapter on war hype as well. And war is so destructive and dangerous that I think it's worth arguing against war to prevent it from happening. And I think so there are some hypes which are so terrible that they should be that we need to have active resistance against them.
I don't mean to sound nihilistic, but I don't think the average person approves of war. It always comes from high up. And whether or not we say anything or however many protests we have, it doesn't seem to make a difference.
Well, that's not entirely true. So I believe that now in Western Europe, it has become culturally very hard to mobilize the population to fight an enemy. And the reason is the low birth rate. So if you have a birth surplus with 3 or 4 sons per family, it's clear that not every son can take on the business of the father, take on the farm and so on. So if you have a birth surplus of males, you need to consume these males. And then you have a cultural situation in which war becomes acceptable and a natural activity. But in Western populations, and the same is true for Russia and China, with so little children, the anti-Northern Hemisphere doesn't have enough children, it's very difficult to convince populations of the necessity of war. So I think that there are cultural preconditions for war that are not met very well anymore. And so therefore, it's actually a possibility that we might be successful in arguing against war in given this cultural situation we are in.
So basically, choose your battles.
Yes, exactly. Now, in the book, you could argue, but you didn't choose your battleships. You covered so many hypes. That's true, but that's because I'm an intellectual sitting at his desk and writing. But if I would be a political activist and fight really in the public sphere in a visible way, more visible way, then I would pick some topics. And this is what political parties do. Now I can afford the luxury to think through different types of hype, but if I would be a real activist, I would pick my battles.
So which battles then do you think are the ones to pick?
I think The most important one is medicine. The most important ones are medicine to fight against this abuse of the medical system for the profit of the pharmaceutical industry against the interests of the population, and to fight this poisoning of the population. Then I think the climate hype needs to be fought because it's destroying us, and it's basically preparing Western countries to be subdued by the East, because the Eastern countries are not following the climate hype, and so they will outperform us industrially more and more, and at some point we will fall into their dominion, realm of dominion. And I don't want to lose my autonomy. I don't want to be governed by Russians or Chinese, to be honest, right? I mean, they may be very efficient, but I prefer the Western model. So I think the climate hype is the second one which must be addressed. And the third one, so medical hype, climate hype, these are the two worst. And then, yes, I think the whole collectivism is very bad as well. The wokeness, I call it diversity, equity and inclusion hype. I think that's also a very bad type of hype because it seduces young people into following an ideology that is solely, they believe they do something that is morally superior, but in reality they are only implementing the rule of a tiny minority. So this is also an important hype to fight and to get back to reason, you know.
We can all have various opinions on what's happening in Palestine with Israel, and we know that American foreign policy is strongly influenced by it's a kind of a pro-Israel or Israel first position, and this connects to the ideology of Zionism. What interests me is what appears to be a very anti-Jewish sentiment.
Yeah, that's very interesting. There's a new wave of anti-Semitism that's very strong that we haven't witnessed since 80 years in Europe and in the whole world. Now, this time it's much more complicated because it's a global phenomenon, because also, of course, there's a lot of pro-Muslim and Muslim origin of this. But ultimately, I think one has to differentiate between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So I come from, my father is from a Jewish family. I have a lot of Jewishness in me. I'm very pro-Jewish, but I'm anti-Israel. I think it was a mistake to set up the Jews in Israel. I think they belong to Europe. So I'm a Euro-Zionist. I would prefer the Jews to live in Europe. It would be great for us, you know, because this is a very gifted people, and culturally and also ethnically very gifted. It would be wonderful to have them back here. So that's what I think would be the best, because I think that the Jews have no future in Palestine because they're surrounded by their worst enemies. And as soon as the US is not able to support anymore the state of Israel, there will be a catastrophe. So I would rather say they should come back to Europe sooner than later. So I'm very much in favor of them being here. So I'm critical of Israel, but very pro-Jewish, which is a rare combination.
Yeah, but the point I was making is that the anti-Jewish sentiment, which is pervasive now across the West,
yes,
it seems to be some sort of manufactured hype. I don't think it's organic.
It has an organic component, which is that there has been in the West always been subcutaneous latent anti-Semitism, which, like, there has also been a Russophobia, and that you basically utilize this. So this is one factor. Another factor is that now we have 25 million Muslims living in Europe, and also I don't know how many million in the US, and they are being taught within their religion that Jews are the enemy. So these are two natural trends, but these trends are exploited to create a hype, and there are political movements which are benefiting from this a lot on the left, right, of the political spectrum. I don't like the left-right distinction anymore, but this is very characteristic of cultural Marxism, and it goes back to Zeitz's book, Edward Zeitz's book, published in the 70s, Orientalism, where he basically criticizes the Western view of Muslims and Islam. And I think there is a postmodern trend that is anti-Semitic, and that postmodernism contains an anti-Semitic threat that is now being exaggerated and exploited.
So in your book, The Hype Cycle, you also reference, what's your name, Arnold Schelsky?
Yes. Well, his name is Helmut Chelsky, and I used the pseudonym Arnold Chelsky because I'm a big fan of Arnold Gehl and Helmut Chelsky. Arnold Gehl was a German philosopher and sociologist, and Chelsky was his pupil. He was a sociologist. That's why I used the combination of their names as a pseudonym.
That's where the confusion comes in. If people look at your book,
yes, exactly. And I didn't write it under my own name because I was afraid that I might suffer repression because of the medical chapter. But then my professional situation has changed, and now I feel free to disclose the pseudonym.
That right there is a major issue of the modern world, Jobs. The fact that you are fearful of publishing your ideas under your name.
Yes. It is, but it's historically the norm. So the period in which we had real freedom of opinion was rather short. The historical norm is that the state is afraid of the citizen and therefore suppresses freedom of opinion. And we are in this situation again. And it's very sad and very dangerous. And I have a lot of, I have had already quite a lot of professional repression, because of my opinions. And they're labeled as right wing or something like this, which is complete nonsense. I'm just a traditional rationalist, Aristotelian and Kantian. I'm just a sober scientist. I have no political agenda of my own. I'm almost apolitical. I'm just in favor of truth and rationalism.
It's interesting because you are referencing the state doing the suppressing, but during the COVID era, all of my videos on YouTube were being removed, and that's a private company.
Yeah, so I think we have that's also something I mentioned in the book, that we have now synthesis of the state and big corporations. So the big corporations and the state work very closely together. And so that the line of difference between the state and the big corporations has blurred. And our state apparatus has become so big that the best business model for big corporations is to work together with the state, because then you don't have to convince end consumers. You can just convince public servants to make a law that privileges you, and then you can sell billions of Corona shots, right? So basically, of COVID shots. So basically, I think we have a private-public partnership in the very worst sense that's dominating Western societies.
A characteristic of a hype cycle is the speed or the acceleration. I'm guessing that you don't get slow hypes.
That's a good point. So no, a hype is by its very nature contagious and fast, and also convincing many people. So yes, there are long-term ideologies or faith systems like Christianity, Islam, but hype movements are usually rapid. And you can see Protestantism as a hype movement that spread very rapidly and very intensely. Yes, so you're right.
Do you get small hypes or small hype cycles?
Yes, there have always been historical examples of small communities following a certain hype. For example, in Münster in the 16th century, there were the Anabaptists, led by Jan van Leyden, and they were a fanatical small community who took over the city of Münster, created their own jurisdiction there, and that was a very local hype. And it had to be brought down by troops, by federal troops, because they were so fanatical. And so, yes, there are such hypes. There are also these sects in which people commit group suicide and so on. So there are also small-scale hypes among closed groups.
I just want to go back to the vaccination hype. Do you think, Jobs, that any of these individuals in these organizations wake up in the morning thinking that they themselves are evil?
This is a super interesting question that has preoccupied the greatest thinkers. Now, I think that there's a small minority who knows it's evil and thinks it's evil and enjoys being evil, the malevolent, as they are called. And Schopenhauer describes, and Dostoevsky has a great example, the Great Inquisitor and the Brothers Karamazov is a malevolent person who knows that he is evil and enjoys being evil. Goebbels was a guy like this. I also believe that Angela Merkel knew that she was evil and enjoying it. So I think that there is a tiny minority of very cynical, very highly gifted people who are basically enjoying being possessed, if you want to put it in very traditional terms. But most of those who follow such narratives think they are doing something that is morally right. So they are not aware of it. Otherwise, they couldn't function. Most of the people are not strong enough to see them, to enjoy themselves being systematically evil. Most of them need to think that what they're doing is a good thing. Otherwise, they couldn't go on. Like Greta Thunberg, right? So these people really think that they are doing something for the benefit of mankind, and they are not aware of that they are following an evil pattern.
I think of individuals like, let's say, Klaus Schwab, Yuval Harari, Bill Gates, even Tony Fauci. Do they wake up thinking that they're evil? I kind of don't think so.
It's very hard to tell. It's very hard to tell. Usually you need to, for contemporary persons, for Angela Merkel, I frankly don't know. But when you look at the past and you have, as a historian, you can read the private correspondence of such people and make yourself a picture, get the disclosed ideas, talk to people who knew them personally. Then you can kind of get a picture of whether they are malevolent or just believing that they were doing the right thing. And so it's hard to tell for contemporaries whether they are seeing themselves as evil or not. I frankly don't know, because you have to know them personally. You have to also to get the opportunity to see into the way they think, and this you can only do through private correspondence, private conversations.
Do you think evil actually exists? Because it's always the other person. It's always the other person who's evil.
Oh no, I don't think so. So I think evil exists, and we all experience it, the tendency to do evil things. So I'm a Christian. So I believe that we are all sinners, and that the primary mode of sinning is to forget about God. Now, if you forget about God, you start to commit other sins as well, like lying or deceiving and so on. And then if you systematically do this and start to enjoy this, then you get into the cycle of evil. And so every one of us has lied and has deceived in a minor way. And so we all know how it feels, to the temptation to act against the laws of God. And this temptation luring yourself into doing this, that's evil. I think it really exists. I think it's a transcendent force, like God is a transcendent force that plays a huge role in our lives. I think the modern view that evil doesn't exist, that it's only a result of our biochemistry, of our brain, a form of aggression, all of that's, I think, nonsense. I truly believe in the transcendent existence of evil, like Paul did, right? Or Jesus himself. And I think Matthew 4 describes very well how the devil tries to convince Jesus. And I think this is a typical pattern. Evil paints itself as beautiful, as positive, as creating order, but it does the very opposite. And it's very tempting, and I think it truly exists, and it plays a huge role for our lives.
And those who enjoy it would be described as sociopathic.
Yes, they are sociopaths, and depending on the power they accumulate, they can create a lot of damage, like Hitler, Stalin, or Mao, who are certainly very evil persons, and it's utterly dangerous. I also think that Fauci is evil. Whether he enjoys it, I don't know, but he has a career of creating a lot of damage in medicine, turning medicine into a weapon against the citizens. I think that these evil people, that this exists, and yes, it had always been a challenge for mankind.
How can my audience get your book, The Hype Cycle?
So they can just go to Amazon and search for it, The Hype Cycle by Arnold Chelsky, and then they can buy it. It's still in stock. It was published in May, so it's still available. And they can also, if you want to know more about my other writing, they can just Google my name, and then they will find my other publications.
I've got your previous book about AI. Where is it now? It's on my shelf here somewhere.
Yeah.
And I'm going to now have to get a copy of this one also, personally signed by you.
I sent you the AI book personally signed, right? Did
yes.
I do that? Yeah, so now I have to also send you the Hype Cycle book. it's actually very costly, you know that.
Oh, okay. All right. We'll,
no,
we'll,
I do it. I don't mind.
All right. Joop Slanggruber, thank you so much for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks a lot for the invitation. Talk to you soon again. Bye-bye, Jeremy.